Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, How Erdc Makes the Difference. You're listening to Season 2, Episode 12. I'm Carol Coleman and we're talking about SMILE. It's all on CoreCam. Today we have with us Dr. Brittany Bruder and Nicholas Spohr, coastal research engineers with the Coastal and Hydraulics Laboratory, or CHL, Field Research Facility, also known as the FRF in Duck, North Carolina. Good morning and welcome to our show. How are you this morning?
Oh, we're doing great. How are you?
Wonderful. Now, we have a lot to talk about today, but before we get into that, I'd like to ask specifically, like Dr. Bruder, what is your role at Erdc?
I have been working at Erdc for about 5 years. I am the PI of CoreCam, which is an initiative to monitor our coastlines using readily available camera equipment. And so I lead that effort. I work a lot with cameras, obviously, and taking measurements that way. I also work with UAS, imagery aboard drones, another term, as well as other types of in-water sensors. And then Nick, I work very closely with Nick Spohr, and so he can also give some background.
Hi, I'm Nick Spohr. I've worked here at the Field Research Facility for about 10 years. I'm a research civil engineer, and I wear a lot of hats around here. I do a little bit of everything. I serve primarily more of as a support role for all the PIs we have here, kind of just shepherding a lot of the data collection, processing techniques, publications here and there. I do a little bit of everything from LIDAR, radar systems, camera systems, and I also serve as ATPM here for all of our UAS operations.
And Nick makes sure that everything is running. He's kind of the gas that keeps everything going. So when there's a hurricane, he's here, in his poncho, making sure everything's running. He's excellent at securing things and data processing, and he's definitely key. He's a PI's dream.
You definitely need people like that. So, Dr. Bruder, if you could tell me a little bit about yourself and your background, and what steps did you take to get where you are, and what's your relationship with the community?
Grew up on an island similar to the Outer Banks, which is where the Field Research Facility is. My family is actually from Chicago, so we were never traditionally beach people. So ironically, I didn't go to the beach that much. However, I was always interested in math and science. When I graduated school, I had a degree in civil engineering. It was during the recession, and I wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be outside. I was familiar with the beach, and I wished to spend more time there. So I kind of just found myself in a degree program that was near where I grew up, where I could live at home for a little bit. I got my master's and then PhD in civil engineering at Georgia Tech. That was actually in tidal energy. I enjoyed working in tidal energy, but my kind of passion was I like to take complex problems and make computer code or make software to try to make it more understandable, first for myself, and then for the general public. So kind of transitioning that science, into, digestible type of information that people can use and take action on, I found really useful. That kind of pulled me towards the Army Corps and to Erdc. One of our missions is to provide support for the district, our district engineers. So, when we take measurements, they don't just see numbers on a page. They see information like dredge here, don't dredge here, nourish here. And to save them a lot of time. So that's kind of where how I've got to the Outer Banks. I think, you know, the field research facility, it's a huge draw because it's, you know, it's an outdoor laboratory. So in doing my PhD and doing schoolwork, I did a lot of field work where we had to travel from Atlanta to the coast. And, you know, you had to bring 10 different screwdrivers. If you dropped one overboard, you were out. You're out of luck. That's definitely happened before where we had to stop whole field efforts because we didn't have a screwdriver. But here, you know, our office is on the beach. So you can go in, go out. If you forget something, you can measure all different types of conditions. And so it's just a really, really special place and kind of a research engineer's dream. You know, in regards to the community, I would say I still feel pretty new here. The community is very close-knit due to the seasonality. And I think, you know, I think when we hear about Nick's story, we'll get a much better picture because I think he's much more in tune with the local community. And
we'll try.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, tell me about yourself and your background and what steps you took to get where you are today and your relationship with the community.
I don't know if I can say I'm officially an Outer Banks local, but I've lived on the Outer Banks for about 22 years. Originally, I'm from up near Richmond, Virginia, but we moved down here when I was in high school, and I got my first sort of exposure to the field research facility in high school on a field trip out here. At that time, the facility was doing a lot of daily tours, so I came out here and really saw that you could have a career kind of hanging out at the beach and observing stuff and collecting really cool data. I would call myself a beach junkie, if you will. I eat, sleep, and breathe wind, waves, a lot of forecast modeling. I'm an avid surfer and fisherman. So having a job that basically puts me in the environment that I prefer to be in when I'm not working is pretty ideal. I finished high school down here at Manio High School and went to NC State University in Raleigh, North Carolina, and got my bachelor's in civil engineering. And as Brittany mentioned, the recession was basically when I was graduating and really struggled to find an entry-level position in the state that made a lot of sense for, you know, what I wanted to do in life. So I tended to pick up a lot of odd jobs here and there. I did a lot of landscaping work. I cooked a lot. I did some sort of PhD support work for several folks that work at NOAA now. And I found myself kind of at the end of a couple years yearning to try to get back to how can I get to the FRF or a similar scenario. So I ended up going back and getting my master's degree about 4 years after my bachelor's. Back at NC State in Raleigh with some good contacts that I'd met in my undergraduate degree. And through a lot of the networking I did, working a lot of those odd jobs during the recession, I was put in contact with some folks down at the Coastal Studies Institute down in Wanchese, which is about 30 minutes south of here. And one thing led to the next. And I'd applied to work here. This is kind of a fun fact. I had applied to work here, or at least as an intern, for every year through high school and after high school through my undergraduate and graduate programs.
Wow.
Hoping someday they would call me back. And it wasn't until I went back to grad school that that first summer I finally got the call back to, hey, come out here, let's try you out and see how well you do. And that was in 2011. And pretty much since then, all history, the one thing led to the next. I was a contract student for a while, which then matriculated into more of a contract temp position. And then that transitioned into a permanent full-time position when we got a new branch chief. And I've loved every second of it.
So persistence is the key.
Yeah, persistence is key. Don't ever give up on yourself. You know, you got to believe in yourself first and foremost because no one else is really going to, you know, get that ball rolling. So you got to, you know, light that fire and really just stay after it and be almost tenacious with it And you'll usually end up, you know, manifesting what you intend to. And I would say in terms of the community, you know, I don't really serve on any boards or any advisory panels, but I do chat to a lot of folks in the community, worked with a lot of private industry firms, just asking for recommendations for how to collect data, process data in a certain way. I serve a lot of data to folks because most of our data is publicly accessible, at least on the civil side. I do a lot with the local SERF chapters. I've even got into a little bit of the surfing with autism stuff. And then some of the fishing, now that I have a two-year-old son, I've really tried to tap into that network and really lead him into a life that he can be, you know, productive and resourceful here on the coast, especially out here on the Outer Banks where, you know, we're not quite in a big city environment. So you kind of have to be resourceful with what's around you.
I think I was going to mention that too after you finished chatting about, because I have a two-year-old as well, and I think that's going to delve us into the community quite deeper. Yeah. And, you know, I expose my daughter to the beach every day we go, so she's familiar with it, respects it, you know, safe, and so she can be a good steward as well for the future.
That's excellent. Excellent.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
They start early at Suds and Smokes on Highway 27, Monday through Friday. They're serving breakfast beginning at 5, and they have plate lunches, too, starting at just $8.99. But you're welcome to stop by Suds and Smokes to other locations as well, 3114 Halls Ferry Road and 887 Highway 61 North. There's always cold beer because they have beer caves, and there's always great gasoline with Tecron that helps keep your engine clean. Ask about their Tobacco Loyalty Club. It'll save you money at Suds and Smokes, where they always welcome you.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
And if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Brittany Bruder and Nicholas Spohr, coastal research engineers with the Coastal and Hydraulics Laboratories Field Research Facility, also known as the FRF, in Duck, North Carolina. So let's set the stage for our listeners who might not be familiar with your facility. I know you're located at the Field Research Facility on Duck Beach in Duck, North Carolina, and that's out on the Outer Banks. So for those who aren't familiar, what is your main mission at the FRF?
So originally the FRF was designed, you know, to keep measuring the ocean and keep observing. We're considered the most studied beach in the world. We have the longest records of monitoring a beach, which is really good for observing things, long-term trends, as well as the seasonal trends. We have a LARC surveys, which are amphibious vehicles, of the nearshore environment back till the 70s, I believe, Nick, that's how far it's gone. We've had imagery, recorded imagery back from the 70s. And so, you know, our mission is to observe all that we can and take that knowledge, and we do science with it. We validate numerical models better so that we can better predict erosion and things like that in other parts of the country. We use that for our civil purposes, and then we also use it for military purposes as well to help protect our soldiers in ocean environments. But we, you know, we develop new technologies. We learn how to better take advantage of existing technologies. Another PI here, you know, and Nick works closely with her. You know, LIDARs are laser scanners that are typically used now in self-driving cars and automation, but Nick's been using them to measure wave shapes. And so same with imagery as well. You know, clearly video imagery is nothing new. However, you know, we've been analyzing it and developing new algorithms to try to find ways we can use it to actually observe our coasts and see what's going on. So all of these measurements we aim, they're all continuous so we can get these long records. You know, I think that's one of the most challenging things about measuring the ocean is that
you have to understand how a grain of sand moves within a fraction of a second, but you also need to understand how the weather patterns change over years or months. So combining all that together is really difficult. So we're just trying to get all the measurements we can.
It's really important work going on at the FRF. So if you could kind of explain to us, what is the CORCAN system and what was the reasoning behind its creation?
So the CORCAN system, its basis is that we take video imagery and we can actually, through a special calibration, we can make it into maps. So when you look at a picture and you say the beach was 10 pixels wide, we can actually look at it and say, oh, the beach is 100 feet wide. And that's really good for engineering design. A lot of our projects are really data starved, particularly the districts, meaning that, you know, when they go and do a dredging project or a beach nourishment project, you know, they take a survey, you know, that means they get out all the equipment, they get the boats, they get the personnel, and it takes about a couple days. The conditions have to be right and safe. And then they usually do the nourishment, do something, and then they take a survey afterwards. And that's kind of how they assess the project. And it's mostly due to cost restraints and personnel and safety. But if we use video imagery, we can, you know, set up a camera and let it run, and it can take a picture every hour for months at a time without anyone being on site, and we can get very similar measurements. We can get measurements right before storms, right after storms. We can better anticipate when we're going to need our beaches refilled, because we get those current up-to-date measurements. And so that's what the aim of CORCAN is to set it up so that our districts can go put out a camera and it connects to our network, and we can start providing them that real-time imagery and information within an hour. Historically, this technology isn't necessarily super new. We've been researching it at the FRF for over 30 years in partnership with Oregon State University and Dr. Rob Holman and John Stanley. However, you know, and it's been used academically for all this time. We have our famous Argus Tower. It's a 43-meter, so that's about 12 stories, I think, 12-story tower that overlooks our beach and provides this hourly maps and imagery, and that's been running for 20, 30 years. Or literally, it's been kind of staying in academia in an ivory tower for that long. And so CORCAN is kind of an initiative to simplify it and bring it so that we can give it out to the districts. So simplify the hardware, not using specialized cameras or anything like that, and simplify the data that, you know, an engineer doesn't need to know how to code precisely, or doesn't need to know, have years of experience of photogrammetry or the math required to do that mapping, that it can all be kind of streamlined. And so that's kind of, where we are, how that is and how it kind of fits into the FRF. So I've been, the PI, I've been working on a lot of the codes and the software, again, to try to help this. Nick has actually taught me a lot about the cameras. He is a pro of installing the cameras, calibrating them, making them weatherproof. That's kind of where we are right now with that.
Yeah, it seems like the trade-off is, you talked about how the boats and the personnel and the weather and everything has to line up for the districts to do like one survey. Mm-hmm. But for our application, we like aim to provide almost this like continuity in measurement where you're continuously measuring everything in between these little discrete events. So it seems like the trade-off is now we have to design these systems to be robust enough to stay afloat and stay alive even remotely, which can be kind of challenging, right? When you have things like lightning, thunderstorms, extreme rainfall events, extreme cold, a lot of cloud cover for, you know, your solar panels that are, you know, requiring a lot of solar energy to charge these batteries. So it's sort of a simple model, but actually requires, you know, a pretty creative and clever, robust design to ensure that the data continuity is, you know, what we intended to be.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Nick hit the continuity part, the time part, which is really important, and then the image part, you know, it's a cliche, but it's true. An image speaks a thousand words. Like, mm-hmm. It's so much easier to communicate, hey, this is how the beach is changing, you know, through a picture versus just like numbers on a page or even a line graph. And so, you know, talking, it's a useful tool not only for the districts to use to make decisions, but also to communicate to the local stakeholders and the public, saying like, this is what the beach was and this is what the beach is now, you know, or this is this. You know, this event happened right now, but we've actually seen it happen three other times before. And so it's a really useful tool to help explain different.
It definitely sounds extremely useful. So I understand that there are three tiers to the CorCan system. Can you tell me about each of the tiers and how can listeners be involved?
We have three tiers of the hardware, and that's how we are trying to simplify how to get these cameras out. So one tier is kind of mimics what we have at the FRF, and that's kind of our Argus tier. And that is, I would say, the most expensive and most complicated to put out. And so the Argus system, that's our most advanced system, is based what we have here at the FRF. It can take high resolution imagery. It can take it at fast amounts. It can pretty much take movies. So it's good for estimating currents. It can be even used to estimate bathymetry or depths in some locations by tracking waves. And so that kind of has the most programmable, customizable type. Now, it requires the most experience to operate as well. And, you know, its price tag is also a bit higher, too. Our next tier is trail cameras. And so the trail cameras are cameras. They're very simple. You could go buy them at your local hunting store. They're solar paneled. And essentially, they can take, you can program them to take a few pictures an hour. They cost about, I would say 20%, or sorry, I have to do the math backwards in my head. They're 20% of the cost of an Argus camera. So they're definitely, you can get four of them with all the bells and whistles less than a few thousand dollars. And so they're really good at observing the type of, they're really good at observing like maximum water level or flooding type of events, where the sandbar is, the shoreline position. So they're really good at observing how your shoreline changes, beach use, things like that. You know, so, I mean, pretty much you wouldn't be able to get maps unless you have the software to do it yourself. But anyone could go buy one of these, have them record, and, you know, if they live on the beach, have a record of how their beach has changed for over years running. And so they're very simple. The third tier is CoastNav. I'm going to let Nick chat about this one.
Yeah, so we've got CoastNav, which is more of a crowdsourced technique of acquiring imagery. This is a pretty clever project. I think it was initiated by some of our collaborators across the Pacific Ocean in Australia and New Zealand. But we kind of collaborated and came up with a pretty clever design, particularly for the back end where all the data goes. But it's effectively just think of a phone cradle that any user could put their cell phone in. This is any type of cell phone from, you know, your Galaxy S13, I don't know what they're on now, and you know, your new iPhones to even maybe some old phones. So we try to design them out so it fits a multitude of phone styles and camera positions. And we have the user go up and basically scan a QR code that walks them through a sequence of steps, positioning their phone in the cradle, taking the image, and then uploading the image to a cloud, a server that will take the image and do some auto rectification or sort of image matching with, say, a baseline set of images. So then we can do some similar things that the trail cam does, like shoreline position, maybe bar position, just general beach widths. But it's all done sort of passively. It doesn't require any sort of infrastructure like a solar panel or anything. It's literally just a piece of metal. It's screwed into a position of opportunity. This is namely usually a place like a fishing pier or somewhere that's going to get you a really nice angle on the shorelines, you know, so you get a nice extent. We've also used maybe hotel balconies, you know, that have like a rooftop bar on them or something. Somewhere where you would expect people to sort of socially be gathered and be curious about what this funny looking metal sculpture is on the railing. And then we also have a nice informational sign that, you know, resides next to it with the QR code that kind of explains the project, explains, you know, the purpose of it and how the community can actually become involved in collecting this data for, say, the district engineers or the scientists that want to better understand the system that either they're vacationing in or that they live in and frequent, you know, maybe on a daily basis. So I think that project is really, really fascinating because it really takes the cost down. I mean, what are you talking, 5%, 1% of what the main or the big Argus camera? I mean, it's scrap metal. So, I mean, it's something that really once it's installed, you know, we'll go out and install the mount, and then we'll usually take a laser scan of the scene, which is probably the most time-intensive part, but, again, you're only looking at a couple of hours of this. Really high-resolution point cloud data will result from the laser scan, and then we can use all of that information that is tied into either a global or local coordinate system to pick out key points that within the image you would be able to stretch it, say, into a real-world map and be able to make, you know, metric measurements, say, of beach width or shoreline position, and tie all that into a map space that a district engineer could actually do quantifiable, you know, work with. And I think it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, that sounds really, really cool. So for our listeners, the next time you're at the beach and you see one of our little CoSnap stands, take a picture and help us track the beaches.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Neal Gas is now Vicksburg's locally owned and operated Cummins Generator Distributor. They sell, install, and service Cummins generators throughout the Southeast. They also sell propane, tankless water heaters, propane fireplace systems, and infrared heaters. But they do a lot more than that. Neal Gas does piping for new and existing homes and for commercial and industrial construction. So when you're building, check with the piping experts at Neal Gas first. They're online at Neal Gas. That's Neal with two L's, NealGas.com.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
And if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Brittany Bruder and Nicholas Spohr, coastal research engineers with the Coastal and Hydraulics Laboratories Field Research Facility, also known as the FRF, in Duck, North Carolina. So where are some of these CoreCam pilot projects located, and how were these sites chosen?
We've had a few different ones. I would say our first, you know, clearly we had some tests here at the field research facility, but I would say our first big successful test was in New Smyrna Beach, Florida. We were working with the Jacksonville District. You know, they have been a really great district to work with, really excited about new technology. New Smyrna Beach, they did something called an offshore placement on their beach. So they took material that they dredged out and they actually placed it. They didn't place it on the beach like you would think of a traditional beach nourishment, but they placed it just offshore of it. And so they wanted to see how it behaved and how it responded to different storms and events, the sand, you know. And so, you know, it's by theory, when you put the beach offshore, it's called a nearshore berm placement, it should come back onto the beach. It can happen through a few different mechanisms, but, you know, it is a leap of faith. You know, for some people, that you're not putting your sand on the beach where it should go. You're putting it offshore, so people are leery about it. And so with the cameras, they were put up in 2018 and 19. They were able to capture what the beach looked like before, during the placement, and afterwards, and how it responded to a few different hurricanes and tropical storms that passed by. And so what we were able to show with the cameras is that the beach did, in fact, grow. We can't say for sure where the sand came from, but the beach did grow, and it did become wider and more sustainable. We were able to see the mechanism that happened with, because we could see where the waves were breaking, so that the cameras actually showed that the waves would hit the pile of sand offshore and break. And then just, you know, onshore of that area, there'd be less wave breaking and less shore break on the sand, and the beach would grow. So it was mostly acting as a buffer, the sand offshore, and not allowing erosive energy to come up onto that area. And so that's how the beach ended up growing. And so with that, you know, the districts are able to show that, you know, to their stakeholders next time they would like to do this, like, hey, this worked. Our beach grew as a result of this. It withstood a few storms. And so we were really, really excited about the promise of that project. We've had a few different other pilot projects. We have a few coast snaps around the Outer Banks area right now that are operated by the Army Corps in Jeanette's Pier on the Outer Banks, Avalon Pier. We're also in a few areas of Virginia Beach and moving into Myrtle Beach in South Carolina. We're putting up some core cams on Folly Beach, as well as Lido Key, Florida, as well. We had a camera install in, I think, one of the more fun locations, Sunset Beach, Hawaii, that had an excellent overview. Unfortunately, that camera station's down, but we're hoping to go refurbish it and bring it back upline. That station was particularly challenging a little bit, mostly because it is so remote, far from the field research facility. So if something goes down, it's tough to get back out there. But we've had great support from the Honolulu district. But, you know, one kind of funny story is the cameras went down and we couldn't figure out why. And finally had our district partners go out and check. And, you know, as Nick was saying, how difficult it is to keep a camera running. We thought we anticipated everything, but we did not anticipate ants coming in, being attracted to the electronic equipment and chewing through wires. So that was the first one for us. But that's another location we had it. Can you think of any other spots? I'm trying to think.
I think that you covered most of them. Yeah. I think Galveston, there was something down there.
Yep. Galveston. And I think we're hoping to get some more West Coast ones soon. You know, and we're working with other district partners and other federal agencies like NOAA. There are some available webcams that publicly put their imagery, and so we're trying to best utilize those as well, so to more efficiently go out and get imagery that's already there. And one example we're doing that is in partnership with the Great Lakes as well in Holland, Michigan. And they're doing a rip current study out there. So not just beach coastlines, but also our Great Lakes coastlines too.
Oh, awesome. Coastlines are ever changing. With the addition of CoreCam, how does the system save time and money?
I think the big thing, and I think we've tapped on it a little bit, is this idea of proactive versus reactive management. You know, a lot of times, you know, if you're basing your design or your maintenance schedules off very limited data or data that's out of date, you know, we don't have a lot of confidence in it. And, you know, if we have a continuous stream of what our coasts are looking like or what a beach project is looking like, we can go and we can better schedule when we need to act. You know, it's the difference between saying like, oh, I see our channel is shoaling. We should probably plan a dredge in a few months versus a boat stuck. We should have been there yesterday. And so, you know, it saves a lot of time and money in that regard. And, you know, just a better relationship with the community as well.
And I think it provides more of like a holistic picture of what is actually going on. You know, we're probably never going to know exactly what's going on, but we talked about the continuity of the data, and a lot of times, you know, you'll have this snapshot, say, 5 years prior, and then, like, now. But you don't really know, like, how your beach is changing that much, and I think, like, seeing everything in between, how certain types of storms affect the beach, and it looks like it's totally eroded 1 month, but then, say, a couple months later, all of it comes back, and then again helps inform the district engineer about, well, maybe it looks optically bad for a month or so, but the budget is still there, say in the surf zone, and say during the summer months when we do see it come back and we have the actual record of that because we have the imagery of it, that we maybe don't have to, you know, freak out quite as much when we do see things lost, that the system can recover, and we start to understand the system more than just a couple endpoints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you only survey your beach every 5 years, if you survey it once in the summer versus once in the middle of the winter, nor'easter season, you're going to get very different pictures, and that could potentially tell a different story.
And that's fascinating. Now, can anyone log in to see the data that is collected through the CoreCam?
Yes, so we are anticipating all of this to be public. We do have a couple of beta examples online, one of Lynn Haven Inlet in Virginia Beach with our trail cams, and the FRF station itself with our Argus camera.
And partnerships are important to everything we do at ERDC. And that's definitely true with the CoreCam, as we've heard today. Can you talk about the partnerships and the future of the technology?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the big things that we found putting all these stations is having ties to the community, talking to people to allow us to put these cameras on their buildings, on their beachfront properties. There's a huge level of trust. You know, we have to, you know, try to show them and explicitly show that we're not spying on you. We're not looking at, the cameras can't move. They're looking directly at the beach, and you know, we map them so you can't even see anything. But, you know, and again, with the CoSnap, you know, it only works if people are taking pictures. So, you know, engaging with people is a huge part. And a lot of communities and businesses are really excited to protect their beach and their property.
And we've listened to a lot today, so what do you want listeners to remember from this valuable conversation?
You know, I think, I guess probably not necessarily tied to CoreCam, but, you know, I think just, you know, women in science has always been a big passion to me, and, you know, just for anybody, don't be afraid to get into science. You know, I used to volunteer with a Girl Scout group, and she said something that was really enlightening to me, was that, you know, a lot of times you ask kids what they want to do when they grow up, and you know, a lot of them will say a lot of noble professions, you know, doctors, nurses, teachers, and they'll say why, and they'll say, 'cause I want to help people. And a lot of people just don't think that engineers, like, you're helping people by being an engineer, by being a scientist. So, you know, it's just you can still do a lot of help by going into science.
Yeah, I think this idea of just solution-oriented problem solving is a good one to take away, that you know, we're always going to have this issue with Mother Nature trying to take away what we all enjoy and spend all of our hard-earned money, you know, to vacation and relax on. And that, you know, through understanding, through monitoring efforts, and in this sense, pretty inexpensive, that it can just pay back so many dividends over and over and over as we start to understand the system a little bit better than maybe we used to.
Respect the system.
Exactly.
Well, thank you both for speaking with us today. I've really enjoyed talking to you and learning about core counts and the FRF, and I hope you come back.
Thank you.
Thanks. That was great.
And thank you for listening to Beyond the Gates. We'll catch you next week.
Now News Talk 1490 and 107.7 FM presents the legendary Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. And now?
Now, the rest of the story. Nearly 5 years had passed since Charles Lindbergh winged his way across the Atlantic onto the front page. Now it's the evening of March 1, 1932. Lindbergh and his wife are in their new country home near the village of Hopewell, New Jersey. Their 20-month-old baby is in the nursery, and before the night's over, a nightmare will begin. Their son will be kidnapped. As the pieces of that gruesome puzzle called the Lindbergh kidnapping case fall again into place, you will be reminded of the many distinguished, undistinguished, who offered to help in any way that they could to solve the mystery, to save the child. Of course, you know that the child was kidnapped and killed on that very same night. But before anyone knew, the offers of aid poured in from high and low. And one in particular from low. A jailbird. A crook who was then cooling his heels in the Illinois Cook County Slammer on a nonviolent rap, and he offered to help. In the early days of the Lindbergh kidnapping investigation, while the authorities were shrugging over meager evidence and false leads, a jailbird, a sympathetic thug residing at Cook County Jail, offered to help. And naturally, this offer drew some press as sort of a warped human interest story. And when a reporter finally got around to interviewing the crook in his cell, the jailbird said, now I'm quoting his exact words, "It's the most outrageous thing I ever heard of. I know how my wife and I would feel if our son were kidnapped, and I sympathize with the Lindberghs. I don't want any favors, but I will do anything I can for that baby." Now, wait a minute before you start cheering for this fella, or at least before you applaud his good intentions. You ought to know that the condition of his services was that he be released from jail. But that's not all. He, the crook, assured the authorities that after the child had been recovered, he would return to jail. And while he was gone, he would leave his law-abiding brother in jail in his place as a hostage. And further, this fellow, remember, he's serving time for a nonviolent crime, and it was a first offense at that. So the offer did seem sincere. But nobody cared. Oh, there were a few who wanted to give the crook a crack at it. I mean, after all, what harm could it do? But the more prominent question, what good could it do, seemed ultimately sensible, and permission was denied. And, of course, we're not going to second-guess history here, because we know now that, in fact, the Lindbergh baby was already dead. In that respect, nothing could have been done. But whether or not this Cook County crook could have helped, whether or not, for example, he might have tracked down the kidnapper before the police did, that's going to be open to speculation forever. But I'm a Chicagoan, and frankly, I'd be willing to bet on him. This can be said, that he, the hoodlum, had as good a chance as anyone, and maybe a little better, because the hood who offered to help had at his disposal an army of hoodlums, a vast network of criminal intelligence with nationwide influence. You see, the crook doing time on a tax rap, the sympathetic thug who proposed to help the Lindberghs with no strings attached, the master criminal who made the offer they could and did refuse, was the godfather of his day, Al Capone. And now you know the rest of the story.